From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we introduce our biweekly series called Informed Voter, Wisconsin's Midterm Elections. It's an interactive series that asks you to let us know what you most want to know about Wisconsin's upcoming election.
It's a good opportunity to hear from readers and listeners what they're thinking, what the issues are.
Then, if you're thinking about buying a car, our automotive contributors share some helpful tips to keep in mind before you step into a dealership.
There are certain dealerships that really are strong at the customer service and at servicing your car afterward. And I'd say those are the dealerships I would want to go to because I know that they are interested in me as a long-term customer.
And we'll talk with and hear some music by Cuban jazz pianist Harold Lopez Nusa ahead of his concert at UWM this evening.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. November's midterm elections could change the balance of power here in Wisconsin and in the U.S. Congress. From hotly contested races to the security of elections themselves, WUWM and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel are partnering to bring you a better understanding of what's at stake on November 6.
Our series, called Informed Voter, Wisconsin's Midterm Elections, is an opportunity for you to help shape our coverage. We join Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio now, along with WUWM's managing editor, Michelle Maternowski, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's politics and government editor, Mike Mulvey.
What's the aim behind this collaboration that the Journal Sentinel and WUWM are doing? What are we hoping to get out of interacting with readers and listeners?
Well, I can speak about the engagement side of things, and it's really the want and the need and the desire to have voters questions and feedback to help shape the coverage that we're doing this election cycle so that we know that we're on the same page as you.
We're having this conversation. It's a Wednesday. These conversations are going to air every other Wednesday between now and the election. What's the Journal Sentinel hoping to get out of this?
Well, for us, it's a good opportunity to hear from readers what they're thinking and listeners what they're thinking, what the issues are. Our, you know, reporters who cover the national, local, state level races would be in a position to help answer those questions. And in turn, that would give them ideas of things maybe we should pursue or when we're out in the field talking to voters, bring up to them. And it's going to be a very intense 2 months. There's a lot of high-profile races, not just for us here in the state and locally, but the national look at the races, the Scott Walker race, the Tammy Baldwin race, and people watching nationally. Is there going to be a blue wave or is it going to be something short of that? There's going to be a lot of interest in what we're doing and fairly short window to do it all.
Every midterm election, I guess, is important, but it seems like this midterm cycle is taking on more importance than many in recent memory.
I think that's probably true. You can't take Donald Trump out of the equation. I think people on both sides of the aisle are looking to see what, if any kind of influence that actually has at the polls. It'll be interesting now that college is getting back up to into gear, what the turnout and efforts to get the turnout up on campuses would be and what that might portend in November, not just here, but nationally. There's some expectations that there would be a very high turnout. If that turns out not to be the case, then that might change some of the things people expect out of the races.
It's interesting to consider that a state assembly race or a state senate race or local races aren't just local races, but in some ways are a referendum on the presidency.
That's true. You know, some candidates, Democrats included, say when they're out in the field, they try not to talk about Trump, figuring people have already made up their minds and really they're running against the opponent, and that's what they should focus on. Others, I think, are much more willing to either embrace Trump and say, you know, I'm all for him, I believe in his policies and we're on the right track, and to have the Democratic opponent attack that different strategies there. We'll see how it plays out. But whether he's named or mentioned by name or not, it's clear he's going to be a big factor in a lot of races.
In this case, the elephant in the room is a appropriate metaphor, just given the GOP symbol.
Right.
Michelle, how does this work when somebody might want to be involved in helping shape the series?
So we started using text for election coverage during the primary when we held debates. And we would have people text a certain number and share questions for the candidates. And it worked out really well. And we got some questions that were right on line with the kind of things that we were thinking about asking the candidates, but also things that were like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. So for this series that we're doing with the Journal Sentinel, we have a phone number. It is 414-269-6404. And what you have to do is text the word election to that number. We'll also have all this information online in case you didn't catch that.
In case you're not listening with a pen in hand.
Yeah, I know, right? I always listen to the radio with a pen right in my hand. what you do is you text that number and you text election to it. And then you'll get some prompts from us that we've set up asking a general question of what do you want to know or better understand about this upcoming election in Wisconsin? So what we're going to do with these questions that we receive is kind of sort through them, see if some are easier to respond, and we can just send you a text with the answer. If themes emerge or, you know, this topic keeps coming up over and over again, we'll answer it in this biweekly series that we're doing together to kind of like dig into some of those harder to answer questions.
And this is like one part automation and one part
people,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Me. WWM Journal Sentinel will be looking through all these questions that we receive and kind of pinpoint how can we best answer them if we can answer them. And the hope is that if you text the question into us, we'll follow up with you before our next biweekly conversation airs. And when we kind of have a sense and a feel like what we want to dig into in that particular conversation, we'll see if you have questions that are specific to whether it's, you know, election security or the governor's race, questions that pertain to that topic that we want to dig into that week.
And this kind of speaks to the age-old dynamic that we face in journalism. How much of what we do is about putting issues in the minds of people to understand, and how much of what we do should be shaped by what's already on the minds of people that read and listen to us?
Well, I think you need to know what people are thinking. We might, again, as journalists, think we've covered the waterfront on that, and then to find out, well, wait, a lot of people don't understand or have a clear understanding, or there's some process or system or factor at play, then I think it's our responsibility to fill those holes. And the press nationally was criticized, you know, rightly so, heading into the 16 election, where there was a pretty serious underestimation of the movement toward Trump and what people, particularly in rural areas, were thinking. And I think it would be a mistake not to listen to what the questions and concerns are from our listeners and readers.
Yeah, and we're calling this series Inform Voter. And voting is so personal that you need to have information to make an informed decision when you go to the polls in November. So I think media, we play a role in making sure you have that information. And I think sometimes, not that we take it for granted, but we live and breathe this political and election news as journalists every single day, that we can't expect someone to follow every single story we've ever done.
Well, thanks to both of you, and looking forward to this interactive series over the next couple of months.
Text us your questions.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Michelle Maternowski is WUWM's managing editor. Mike Mulvey is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's politics and government editor. They are spearheading our biweekly series called Inform Voter, Wisconsin's Midterm Elections.
We're asking you to participate in this series, and it's really easy to do. Just text ELECTION to 414-269-6404. That's 414-269-6404. Wait for the prompts, and then tell us what you want to know or better understand about Wisconsin's upcoming midterm elections. Between WUWM and the Journal Sentinel, we'll do our best to answer your questions so that you can be a more informed voter this November. There is more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up, buying a car. If hearing that sentence was enough to make you break out into a cold sweat, stay tuned. We'll have some tips on navigating a car dealership when Like Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Like Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. It ranks up there with one of the most stressful things you ever have to do. Yes, we're talking about buying a car. Whether it's new or used, a car is one of the most expensive items you'll ever buy.
Even though the internet has helped consumers arrive at a dealership armed with more information, that hasn't always helped change the overall dealership experience for them. And depending on that experience, it's very easy to feel you've gotten a bad deal.
Auto contributor Mark Savage feels your pain. So this month, he chats with fellow contributor Dan Harmon about ways to navigate a dealership so that you come out with not only a good car at a fair price, but with good feelings about the overall experience itself.
I think dealerships obviously run the gamut. You know, we can't stereotype too much, but I think the stereotype of the, you know, the guy in the Hawaiian shirt or the plaid suit selling you the car and, what can I do to get you in the car today? I'm sure they're still out there because otherwise that stereotype probably would have died all together. But a couple of trends is that retailing is changing so much because we do know what's on the internet and we can look up pricing and so forth. And that's for every product, not just for cars. I think there's a couple things. Is that the dealerships are getting bigger because there's more combinations, more people selling multiple brands. It's like big box stores. You know, eventually there's only the Walmarts and the Myers and so forth out there, and Targets. And it's going to be the same way with dealerships. You know, eventually there'll be one or two big dealerships in an area, I think, and they'll control the market and they'll have all the different brands. But right now, consumers have a chance to go online. I always tell people to go to KBB, which is KellyBlueBook.com, KBB.com. You can look up the invoice price of the car, and you know that that is not always 100% accurate, and you know that dealers sometimes have rebates they can offer, or they have special financing deals that they have received from the manufacturers. So there's always some wiggle room, but at least you have a starting price and you know what to go in with and work from there instead of going in and saying, oh, gee, that car is, $39,995. Well, really, it cost them $36,000. Okay, now I know that. I know they've got to make a little money. You got to allow them to make something on the car. I mean, that really is only the fair thing to do. But people are also generally, I'll say lazy, because they may look it up, but they go in and they get influenced by, hey, they got one and I love that color, or someone likes this feature on the car. You know, one of the if it's a husband and wife, somebody likes a certain feature and they get sold on that. And salesmen are salesmen. They are professionals at this. They know what to play up and, how to maneuver and trying to get people to take what they would like them to take, which is usually the higher-priced car, at least the extra features that are available on the car. So, you know, it's a naturally a adversarial position. The person that's there is trying to sell you the car at the highest price possible and with the most features on it, and you're going in, hopefully, with the mindset of, I want to pay as little as possible. and arm yourself with information before you go in. So that, you know, I know the dealers, and there's probably dealers out there that will listen to this and cringe to say, you know, we haven't changed at all, because I'm sure most of them have changed somewhat because the manufacturers work with them some to demand that they upgrade their facilities and their people. And I think, as you said, there are certain dealerships that really are strong at the customer service and at servicing your car afterward. And I'd say those are the dealerships I would want to go to, because I know that they are interested in me as a long-term customer, not just as a quick sale.
Those are the ones that we need to find and use, right? Because they are interested in, they know that if you're treated well, you're going to be a repeat customer down the road when it's time to get a new car. And that's great. That's the way it should be.
Right. And I would say when we bought our car about 2 years ago now, that was one of the selling points too, was the dealership we went to here locally was very good at that. One, the salesman wasn't high pressure. He worked with us. We knew what we wanted when we walked in, and he told us what was available, and we worked at it. But we also knew they had good customer service and that they had a nice service department. And, you know, that counts for a lot. And if you're treated professionally there, and my wife would be driving this car mostly, so she wants to be treated with respect when she gets there, and you don't want to be, oh, it's just a woman, and we're going to sell her everything as we walk in the door, and we're going to take advantage. If you get that feeling, I think most, especially female customers, are going to say, I'm not going back to that place at all.
And I guess I'm arguing today that those places do still exist, and they're not the exception. I think that they're one of the other half. This is just my opinion based on my experience recently, but.
Well, right, and like I say, I'm sure there are bad dealers out there, or what we would call maybe annoying dealers, that you just don't want to have to deal with.
But
a good reason to shop around too.
Yeah,
you know, to
absolutely.
Go to several dealers with the same make and find out who's treating you with respect.
All right, so two other things, and of course there are forums out there online, and no shortage of things that dealers try to, you know, separate you from your money, but. One of the other ones, and there's one more after this I want to just get your opinion on, is the trade. Because some they're just so obsessed with your trade-in, I'm not sure why. Where I live, apparently there is a shortage of good quality used cars, so, you know, low mileage, well cared for cars. So as soon as they know that you're trading something in, it becomes this whole other negotiation, not just the new car, but the trade. And I found that the dealer that I was working with, who I would describe as not very reputable, they said, yes, we'll give you this amount. And, you know, I have it in writing that this is the amount they were going to give me. And then when it came time to actually sign the paperwork, they quote unquote forgot to put it on the closed sheet. And I reminded them that it's not there. And they went back and they brought back the new closed sheet, and the trade-in price was a little less than half of what we agreed on. So without even telling me, without even any discussion, they slipped it on there as less than half of what we agreed on. And I pointed out that, of course, that's not what we agreed on. Here is the initial offer that had the amount that the salesperson agreed on. And then they proceeded down the road of, well, we can't sell it at that price, and blah, 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 blah. There are all these kinds of reasons that the original one was not a good trade-in. So essentially what they're doing is they thought this customer would close under any circumstance. You know, like, I wouldn't care that I'm not going to get as much for the trade, right? So they're playing that game. It's a game.
It's a bait and switch game, yeah.
It's a bait and switch, and then B, it is, they're playing with emotions, and they're kind of trying to wear someone down because they just want the car, you know, so they're not going to put up too much of a fight about it.
Well, right. That's another key negotiating tactic, is to act like you're not that sure about the car. Maybe you're going to go elsewhere to look for something anyway.
Well, I did. I just walked out. It was offensive. So, but the overall point here is that this kind of thing is still going on every day. So this has nothing really to do with the internet. This is very old school tactic.
I would agree. That's an old school tactic, and like I say, I would not want to go back to that dealership or. And certainly wouldn't be telling any of my friends to go there either. I think, you know, a bait and switch tactic is out there and always will be. Anytime there's a negotiation in a process, the key thing for me, if I'm trading in a car, is to know, one, what I'm willing to pay for the new car, negotiate that first, and then if they've asked you about a trade-in, say, I'm not sure yet, you know, leave that out on the table. And then when you know what you're going to pay for the new car, say, okay, you know, if you want to take a look at my car, take a look at it and then tell me what you think it's worth. Then, like, say, if they come back with a price, make sure they write it down, and then I would want that on the sheet immediately and say, okay, well, if I'm paying $25,000 for the car, my used car is worth $5,000, okay, now I'm down to $20,000, right? And then obviously they always have to add tax later, but I would say ask them to figure out the taxes and any other fees that are going to be on there, because you want to know the total price of the car before you're, you know, negotiating any further.
Okay, so then just another big one, which is this is all going on simultaneously. This dealership has a kind of intake form, and I've seen it at other places as well. I'm not just picking on this one dealership, although I do think they're pretty scummy. So they have a form that it asks you for your social security number, which this is before any kind of negotiation goes on. It's just on the form, and I said, I'm not giving you that information. That's completely irrelevant. You actually should never even give that number at all, even if you're buying, if you go all the way and buy the car. So I called my bank just as part of the whole process, and I asked the representative, is there any particular reason why they would be asking for that? To me, the only reason you give that number is if you're applying for credit, which I wasn't. So the representative said, well, that's part of something that is not such a good tactic, or there's legislation to try to make it illegal to do what they were doing. And of course, we don't know for a fact that they were, but essentially dealers that do that are applying for credit for you without you knowing it and without your permission. So, and then you actually do somehow get a loan and they somehow make money on that. And even if you don't even if you go finance through somewhere else, there's still a loan in your name out there.
I've not heard that. You know.
It's very, very, in my opinion, sketchy, and it's certainly not honest for sure. So that's something else that's going on out there. It's just another way for them to, you know, make money on you, and it can end up trashing your credit. Or another theory was that, you know, since there's this loan on the car that you don't know about, like if you were to get in an accident and the car is totaled or it's stolen, you still owe money on that loan, is another scenario. So it's just something it's still out. I mean, this is kind of my overall point, which is we shouldn't be lulled into thinking that everything is so much better these days just because we think that we are so much better informed, because clearly a lot of people are not, because this kind of thing is still going on.
Well, right. And I think, you know, what you're saying is it's the typical buyer beware, and think about this before you do it. Do your research so at least you do know as much as you possibly can know before you walk in there. No matter, you know, any other big purchase the same way, a house or, you know, some other big boat or something. Know as much as you can before you go in there so that they can't take advantage of you. And like I say, some dealers will and some dealers won't. And obviously, we hope that most are not going to lean that way. And another tactic I've heard of is people saying, well, you know, how much do you want to spend per month, and trying to lock you in, like, okay, I want to spend $300 a month on a car payment. Well, I can put you in this. Well, yes, but is it $300 a month for, you know, 36 months, 48 months, 60 months, how many months? Don't even think of negotiating that way. Go in knowing what you want and what price range you want. And, you know, we'll all have a couple $1,000 range probably that you can what's your upper end and what's your lower end. But know that before you go in, and that way you're not negotiating on their terms. And if they're pushing you that way, again, my advice is like you did. You pack up and say, adios, I'm out of here. I don't need to deal with this sort of thing. It's very rare, maybe in some small towns, that you can't find another dealership that will carry the same line of cars. But, you know, go where you're wanted and go where you're treated right. And you know, you were talking about credit ratings. Make sure you know your credit rating when you go in if you're going to be applying for credit. My other advice, and my experience has been over the years, is credit unions are great at car loans, and they usually have a little lower rate than other people, and many times you can pay them off a little more quickly. So I would always start and have my loan already set up. Say, you know, I've got $10,000 down payment, or my trade-in is what I think it's worth, and I need $15,000 more. Make sure you've already got that loan in your pocket when you walk in. Then you can just say, hey, I don't need credit. I've already got this. I'm all done. And then, as I mentioned earlier, know your total costs before you do anything else. Don't negotiate after, as I said, here's the final cost, here's the tax on it, here's the closing fee or whatever. Licensing, they can't change. That's set by the state. They gotta charge you for the license. But, you know, again, it's know what you're doing. Know what you're doing when you walk in. Make sure that you are prepared. And when you start feeling creepy and things aren't going right, that's when you walk out the door. Don't hand them your driver's license. And if you simply must at a dealership to go take a test drive, get it when you come back in and say, that's fine. I'm looking at several dealerships and I'm going to try several cars. You know, you've got to stay in control. It's like any other situation where you're going to negotiate. You want to have as much control as possible. And like I say, I don't know. I would not be going back to a place that made me feel creepy at all, or made my wife feel creepy. And I think another good idea is talk to all your friends. Where have they gotten their cars? If they've had a bad experience, well, you probably will too.
And I agree with everything you just said. I would only add one more caveat to all this, which is when you're doing your research online about prices and cars and MSRP and dealer cost, I think it would also be a very good idea to refresh yourself on negotiating tactics, dealer tactics, those kinds of things that kind of creep up on you, especially if you're going to close on a car, for example, all the fees and other negotiating tactics. So I think that would make you a much more informed consumer, because it isn't just about price. It's about how the interaction with your salesperson and after the salesperson, you're going to be talking with a finance person and perhaps a general manager as well. So there's a whole second half of the negotiation that comes after the price is negotiated.
Well, right, and I think many larger cities have dealer associations too, like we have Adam here in our area. And if you want to know what is legit and what you should be able to see on an offer sheet, you know, give them a call. They've got it. They'll tell you, and it'll be pretty obvious to you if somebody's adding on something that doesn't belong there.
And you can tell I'm perhaps on a little bit of a mission with this interview, but I would, and to be fair, I had a very good experience with a dealer that I actually did buy a car from, a different one, who were much more reputable and approachable and professional. But I would say, if you're going to go through the trouble of writing a negative Yelp review, which I think everyone should if they have a bad experience, maybe take it one step further and write a letter to the State Licensing Bureau, the part of the state that actually licenses dealerships, because I know that they are definitely interested in hearing when things go creepy. Yeah, because some cases they are actually breaking the law.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the good dealers in your area, like the guy you bought from or the person you bought from, they want you to do that too, because they don't like having those competitors out there. Trust me, no one probably is more disgusted by them than the people who are doing business above board and trying to do things the right way.
Right, except that they often can drive business our way if we're a good dealer, yeah.
Right, that's true.
Well, I guess having said all that, I hope everyone has fun shopping for cars, despite all that.
I'm sure most people enjoy that experience. They want to get that new car, and they don't care what color it is or what dealer they get it from. They just want it right now. Sorry, right. Tesla.
All right. Well, thanks again, Mark.
All right. Thanks.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column Savage on Wheels for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He's also the editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Comblock Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Jan Harmon regularly to talk about cars.
We will take one last break and then meet Cuban jazz pianist Harold Lopez Nusa. He's in town to perform at the UWM Fine Arts Recital Hall this evening. We'll learn more and hear some music when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. ¶¶ Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Jazz is a distinctly American art form, but that hasn't stopped musicians from other cultures and countries from finding their way into it and making it their own.
Cuba has put its cultural stamp on jazz with giants like Tito Puente, Arturo Sandoval, and Chucho Valdez. American jazz artists like Cal Tjader and Dizzy Gillespie looked to the small island off the coast of Florida and took its Latin influences into their own music. And now another generation of Cuban musicians take center stage.
Cuba's Harold Lopez Nusa was born in 1983. He began playing piano at a young age, and his music today is a fusion of American and Latin jazz, Afro-Cuban, and other Cuban folk music, and European classical forms.
Lopez Nusa and his trio will perform at the UWM Fine Arts Recital Hall tonight, but we caught up with him at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music yesterday afternoon to chat and get a preview. First of all, Harold Lopez Nusa, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Oh, thanks to you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and mucho gusto.
Encantado. Mm.
So before we get into talking, I'm hoping you'll play a little something
us. Yeah,
and tell us what it is.
I was thinking that maybe I can play some from the CD. This is a piece by Ernesto Lecuona, who is one of the greatest Cuban piano player and composer. We call it like classical Cuban music. So I learned this specific piece in the school when I was a child, and we revisited it in the city. So I will play it for you.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thanks. So much fun for me to sit right next to you and watch your hands. At some points, they were going so fast, they were blurring, and I'm only a couple of feet away from you. So I guess I want to start right there with the idea of Cuban classical. There is so much, for such a small island, there's so much music and so much influence from other things. You have the Afro-Cuban, you have classical influence, you have American jazz. All of those things kind of melted together in Cuba.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We are lucky to have this great heritage from those big names of Cuban musicians like Ernesto Lecuona, like Cervantes, who they went to Europe to study classical. They were classical training, and then they like mixed between African influence and even jazz and even many things. So they were the pioneers of all of this. And yeah, we built on a small island, but music is really, really important for us. There is a lot of history over there from Africa, from Spain, from the States, of course. The jazz is also part of our, it's almost like we feel very like it's not from us, of course, definitely from the States, but we feel like we have our own jazz and our own way to play jazz. So I'm very proud to be Cuban and to make part of this history of music.
I think that's exactly it, that there is a way that Cuban musicians have made jazz theirs. It's you've made it your own. You tell your stories through the jazz, and all of those influences come to bear.
Definitely, that's what we're trying, and it's thanks to those big names. I just mentioned Ernesto Lecuona, Cervantes, but then there is Bebo Valdez, the father of Chucho Valdez, Gonzalo Rubalcaba before Rubén González, Lili Martinez. There is a big list of piano players who mix Cuban style, classical and jazz before us, and where we learn from them, and then we start our own way to try to do the things.
One of the things I love about your new album is that you mix all of those influences into different songs, into different tunes on the album. Mm. So I hear certain ones that are very classical influenced, the European classical tradition. Yeah. Then I hear things that I could have heard in Chicago or New Orleans. You know, there's a certain kind of rhythm and a certain chord structure. And then I hear things that are absolutely Cuban or South American. There's South American influence as well.
Definitely. We are an island, we have a lot of influence coming in, even if we were close a little bit. But even like that, we always were looking to what's happened here in the state, what was happening all the world. When I was in the school, I remember that, well, it's still very hard to find some records from, for example, from jazz musician in the state. It's very hard because you can't find it in Cuba. You don't have internet, you don't have a shop to buy the CDs, but I don't know how every single Cuban musician have all the music. We are always looking forward what is going to happen, what is the new release. When somebody have one album, then we copy illegally over there. So so that's the way. And everybody's looking for what is happening outside Cuba. And this, of course, influenced all the music, not only the jazz, popular music, timba, everything that happened in Cuba have a lot of influence from the outside also.
Now, you have a classical training.
I did in the school, like classical training. That's what we learn in the school in Cuba, yeah.
I can tell by the way you play because you use the whole keyboard. You have that technique, you know, that you put everything onto, which is wonderful to hear. But then you have, in the piece we just heard, you did a little variation in there, didn't you?
Oh, yes,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I took the original, and then I go some somewhere else.
That's the jazz.
that's the magic of the jazz, yes. That's what we love.
Do you think now that things are a little more open between our countries that the music is going to start? I mean, we've always had Cuban music here. It's like getting our music to you, like you said.
Yeah.
Do you think there's more of a trade happening now?
Well, hopefully, yeah. I think if things getting more open, well, we're going to have more Cuban musicians coming to the States, and also more American musicians coming to Cuba, play with Cuban musicians, share music and share ideas. So that will be very helpful for us, for here. I mean, people need to be together, and I think that music could do that. I mean, music can speak in every language and can put people together. Don't matter what political party you are, no matter if you are what the color of your skin or what is your religion. I mean, music can put together people from all around the world, then this is magic, and hopefully this approach continue. Right now it's a little hard because it's getting more tension again, but still, well, we are here, we are making a tour for our album release, and I'm very happy to this because I love play for the American audience, and I love to share my music with all the guys here. So hopefully we continue in this way and not again with
go back.
We'll see.
I'm hoping that you can maybe demonstrate a little something for me on the piano, taking say a jazz standard and how you might do it Cuban style, how you might bring in the Cuban influences to make it yours.
Let me try something.
Okay.
I will try with, this is the first standard piece that I learned from my uncle, so I will try something like that.
It went right into the rhythm. The rhythm changed. It was wonderful.
Yeah, the rhythm changed. It's more like syncopated. Mm. Instead of the... instead of it's a different feeling.
Right. And then also, there was a little bit in the chord, too. There was a little change and a feeling there.
Yeah, also, it's not just rhythm. It's also melodies that remind us our tradition and harmonies. Of course, our harmonies are not so rich like in jazz, but both, the mix of both could be very, very nice. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot.
So for you, now that you've got the new album out, you're touring with the trio. The trio is going to be here tonight
definitely.
At the Fine Arts Auditorium. When you bring the music to the United States or to Europe, wherever you're taking it, do you find that people respond to it, that they really love what the Cuban influence is on this kind of music?
I think so. I definitely feel that people here in the States, they understand what we do, and they really appreciate what we are trying to do. I mean, of course, we would love to have more and more people who support us and to know about what we do. But I always feel the response is is positive, and I feel very comfortable with it. It's true that sometimes in some countries they don't know too much about Cuban music, but it's not the case of the States. Even in this more small cities, there is some Cuban up there living there. There is some Latino people over there, so they can know about what we are trying to do. So yeah.
Well, it's just so wonderful that you're back here. How many times have you played here now?
Well, it's my second time.
Second time.
Hopefully not the last one.
Not the last, no. No, we want you to come back. We absolutely do. I'm hoping that you'll wrap up with something that you love, either from the new album or something. I want to go back. Before I let you I want to talk to you about composition a little bit, about writing your own things.
Okay.
How does that work for you? Does it come with a melody first?
Well, usually came like sometimes it's a melody, sometimes it's just a groove or rhythm. Usually came not with my instrument. Usually came when I'm traveling in a plane, in my home, doing something with my daughters. I don't know. I always try to record in my phone, singing, and I don't think too very well. So, but I have my phone full of ideas that came to me in the night, in the afternoon, anytime during the day. Then when I'll listen in the game where I was recording and trying to translate to the piano. Sometimes it's hard because I think too bad. But anyway, I love this. The process that I have one idea, then I come back to the idea. I try to find something to translate this idea from my phone to the piano. And then sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not that good. But all the process is wonderful. I mean, I love all the parts of the process. And then when I get something that I think that could be work, I share with the guys, with the trio, with the musician that I work with. And then it's when the final music came in, because they also put a lot of things in my compositions. They choose his own way to translate what I'm trying to play. So that's the whole process is just wonderful. Yeah.
Do your daughters like your music?
Oh, I hope so.
Do they listen to you, or do they say
they listen to? They
Papa,
listen
you're,
to,
you're
they,
practicing again.
When I saw that they dance, them I'm happy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, would you take us out with something of yours
Your
daughters have danced to?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I will. Oh, this is Hialeah. This is also in my new CD.
Carl López Nusa, muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias a usted. Un placer estar aquí.
Cuban jazz pianist Harold López Nusa recorded at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music.
López Nusa and the rest of his trio will perform at UWM's Fine Arts Recital Hall this evening. There is more information at WUWM.com. Jason Reavy recorded and mixed our on-site interview.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Lake Effect returns tomorrow at 10, and I certainly hope you will join us then here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next, and it's 11 o'clock.